All right, it is my honor to introduce our next speaker. Is David Bowes of the Cato Institute. David has been a key figure in the growth of the libertarian movement for the last 30 years. He is the vice president of the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, and one of the largest think tanks in the United States. Oh, really? You can't hear me? I thought I had a bigger mouth than that. I guess not. David Isbin is the executive vice president of the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, Washington, D.C. He has been since 1981 the director of directing policy there and has edited and publicized over 200 books and policy papers on and really just on issues such as school choice, drug legalization, and entitlement reform to the mainstream thought. He cut his political teeth working on Ed Clark's 1978 gubernatorial campaign in California, Mr. Clinton, which is one of the five biggest, best results still in the history of the Libertarian Party for a gubernatorial campaign. He also worked on Ed Clark's 1980 presidential campaign for the Libertarian Party. He's the author of the book, The Libertarian Mind, that came out last year. I read this book three times. If you haven't read it, it's a very good book. I urge you to get it. This was an updated copy of his previous book, Libertarianism Primer, which came out in the late 90s and had a profound effect on me as I was becoming a libertarian. He has appeared on lots of different talk shows, including Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, Firing Line, Talking Points, Book Notes, and has been on over 6 hours worth of interviews on public radio, and he's here to tell us about how we can reclaim our freedom. Please welcome David Bowes.
Thank you, Bob.
Can you all hear me? I won't turn this back on if everybody can hear me anyway. Some of you may have noticed I've been banging my head against the wall at the prospect of a Trump versus Clinton presidential campaign. It certainly seems to me that if it ends up being Trump versus Clinton, or God forbid, Trump versus Bernie Sanders, that there ought to be room for a sane, accomplished third-party candidate. He wouldn't have been my choice, but I thought Michael Bloomberg would get into this race, and if I were Michael Bloomberg, I would have just made bumper stickers that said, "Bloomberg, he's not insane." To start, but I expect there will be better choices than Michael Bloomberg. It is a pleasure to be here today in the state that was the home of Charles Carroll of Carrollton, a great advocate of American independence and freedom, and the last surviving signer of the Declaration of Independence, and Luther Martin, who warned at the Constitutional Convention a few years later that the Constitution, whatever its intentions, would come to be used as a blueprint for centralized government, a powerful president, and a militaristic foreign policy. Fortunately, none of that came to pass. As Dee said, the state where George Washington stunned the whole world by giving up the power he had achieved on the field of battle. This probably hadn't been done since the legendary Cincinnatus. It's a great scene. If you've ever seen a painting, probably an imagined painting of George Washington resigning his military commission, it's a great thing. And, of course, Maryland and Baltimore are the home of the great H.L. Mencken, who said, among many other astute and acerbic commentaries on democracy, that as democracy is perfected, the office of president represents more and more closely the inner soul of the people. On some great and glorious day, the plain folks of the land will reach their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be adorned by a downright moron. But enough about the current campaign. I want to talk about the last few years of libertarianism. It's been an interesting time. If you've been a libertarian as long as I have, you remember that there was a time when nobody talked about libertarianism. We were lucky if we could get them to think we said libertine or librarian. But the past few years, there's been a lot of talk about libertarians and libertarianism. I see headlines in the newspapers, libertarian faction of Congress blocking. I'm always like, who is that? That's like Rand Paul. But I think a lot of this started with Ron Paul's 2008 campaign for president and then his 2012 campaign for president. And, you know, sort of what happened in between was Ron Paul warned that the Federal Reserve was dangerous and creating unsound monetary conditions, and nobody listened in 2008. And by 2012, everybody knew it was true. And Ron Paul warned in 2008 that the government was spending too much money, but there was a Republican president, and so no Republican wanted to believe that. And Ron Paul warned in 2008 that we'd been at war for almost a decade and wasn't that long enough. And by 2012, even Republicans were saying, yeah, that's been long enough. So all of that was good. And then, after most of that, you had the financial crisis, the Wall Street bailout, the automobile bailout, the Obama stimulus, the Obamacare. And there's a huge reaction to all of that. And a journalist wrote about that time, the philosophical casualty of the Great Recession was supposed to be libertarianism, but signs to the contrary are thriving. The Obama administration brought with it ambitions of a resurgence of FDR and LBJ's active state liberalism, and with it, Obama has revived the enduring American challenge to the state. Now, it would be nice if the regular backlash against big government power grabs would happen before the power had been grabbed instead of after, but it's still good when it happens at any time. There have been some interesting polling results recently, I think, for libertarians. If you study American public opinion, then one of the things you would know, one of the questions that gets asked all the time, in the 1960s, more than 70% of Americans consistently told pollsters that you can trust the government in Washington to do what is right all of the time or most of the time. In a Pew poll last year, the number of people who said that was 17%. That's the decline in trust in the government. One of the things that happened during this decline was the pollsters never offered the option of never, but people started volunteering it. And some of the renditions will show never volunteered 2, 5, 8. The never was growing. There are also regular polls that are taken that ask people, on the whole, would you prefer a smaller government with fewer services or a bigger government with more services? Or actually, they don't usually say bigger government. They say a more active government, which is a softer way to offer this. Those numbers change from time to time, but one time recently when I was looking at it, smaller government led by 58-38. Now, you know, Dee knows, when you say smaller government with fewer services, you're only telling half the story. And you're sort of telling the half that makes smaller government maybe not so attractive. When you change this question to what I think is more honest, would you prefer smaller government with fewer services and lower taxes, or a more active government with more services and higher taxes? Then the number changes from something like 58-38 to 66-22. You just remind people that the cost of services is taxes, and 16% fewer want the bigger government with more services. Gallup polls recently have been finding that 55-60% of Americans say the government is trying to do too many things that should be left to businesses and individuals. Now, some of us would say, how can only 60% of Americans think that? But in terms of polling, that is a high watermark. It's been gradually moving up. And perhaps most interesting for some of us, every year Gallup asks one of its polling samples two questions. Some people think the government is trying to do too many things that should be left to individuals and businesses. Others think government should do more to solve our problems, which you agree with. And secondarily, they ask, some people think the government should promote traditional values in our society. Others think the government should not favor any set of values, which comes closer to your own view. And by doing these two questions, they then divide the public into liberal, conservative, libertarian, and I think their term is populist, one might say statist. If you think the government if you think the government is doing too many things that it doesn't need to do, and it should not promote any particular set of values, then they classify you as a libertarian. And just last fall, they found for the first time that the largest group of Americans answering those two questions was libertarian at 27%. Libertarians had been growing from 17 to 21 to 24 to 20. 27% now, 26% were conservative, meaning they favored traditional values and smaller government. Now, we know that just because you say yes to these two questions doesn't make you what we consider a libertarian. It does mean that in some sense, you're putting yourself outside the liberal box and the conservative box. You're not part of the blue Democratic base or the red Republican base if you give the libertarian answer to both of those questions. So one of our tasks as libertarians, whether we're authors or TV producers or political leaders, is to reach that 27% of Americans who say, well, I don't really agree with the Democrats on this, and I don't really agree with the Republicans on that. When we got the Wall Street bailouts and the health care bailout and Obamacare, there was a huge reaction. Some people called it the Tea Party. Some called it a turn to the right. It was a turn to the right in some sense in American politics. But remember, right about that time, the same time that the Tea Party revolt against Obama is happening, there's also a turning of the tide on marijuana laws, and we're seeing states start to change their marijuana laws. Almost never by the legislature, it's by the people. And also at that same time, right during the Tea Party era, there's a changing of the tide on marriage equality. And you could argue that that started right here in Maryland. There were four elections on election night 2012 in which voters voted for gay marriage, and since Maryland's polls closed first, that means that progress happened in Maryland first. And then a little bit later, indeed right after the re-election of President Obama, which is very convenient for him, you had what I call the libertarian Lollapalooza of federal government scandals. How many scandals? I don't have time to count them all, but let's just remember, we're talking like 3 years ago. The IRS targeting Tea Party groups, the cover-up and lies about what may have happened in Benghazi, scooping up the telephone records of AP reporters, spying on both the phone calls and emails of a Fox News reporter, and then the revelations about massive surveillance of all our phone calls and emails by the NSA, which for the Obama administration at least had the convenient effect of sweeping all the other scandals off the front page because this one was so much bigger. And as I wrote then, now that the Obama administration's abuse of power has got our attention, can we broaden our focus from these scandals to take in health care mandates, recess appointments, campus speech regulations, the anti-constitutional independent payment advisory board, the similar extra legislative bodies in the Dodd-Frank bill, the expropriation of Chrysler creditors, and illegal wars? Well, the answer was we couldn't get a lot of media attention for those things. But even in the absence of that, these scandals and revelations pushed a lot of the electorate in a libertarian direction. They revived memories of Rand Paul's filibuster about the use of drones. They got senators of both parties asking tough questions about exactly what the government thought it had been authorized to do in terms of surveillance, and about the secret memos in which it claimed to have authorized itself to do more than Congress remembered. These scandals were so shocking, and this was actually before the Snowden revelations about surveillance. It was mostly focused on the IRS abuse. These scandals were so shocking that Michael Gerson, the former Bush speechwriter, who is now the most vociferously anti-libertarian political columnist in America, wrote a column in the Washington Post titled, "Making Libertarians of Us All." You have got to be going some to get Michael Gerson to start thinking libertarian. And these things I'm talking about that are happening are not happening only here. 8 years ago, there was no National Libertarian Student Group in America. Now there are two, Young Americans for Liberty and Students for Liberty. And Students for Liberty are holding a massive conference in Europe today, the European Students for Liberty Conference, and they're also expanding into Asia and Latin America and Africa. couple of years ago, The Economist, the leading magazine in Great Britain, reported on a poll. They wrote, young Britons have turned strikingly liberal in a classical sense. The young want Leviathan to butt out of their paychecks as well as their bedrooms. Britain's youth are not just more liberal than their elders, they are also more liberal than any previous generation. And then, you can believe this if you will, but there was a poll reported in the leading newspaper in Turkey in which 81% of the protesters then occupying the square in Ankara told the pollsters that they were libertarian. Okay? But this is all politics. I come from a think tank. I don't put my faith in politics. Political attitudes can change. What's important is to develop the principles of liberty and limited government and to promote them. And that task is up to us. And the first thing we have to do is understand what it is we stand for. I like Adam Smith's phrase from The Wealth of Nations, the obvious and simple system of natural liberty. You leave people alone, you have a few simple rules, don't hit other people, don't take their stuff, keep your promises, and you get natural liberty. People live their lives as they choose, they make their own decisions, they trade with other people, they keep their promises or their illegal consequences, also cultural and commercial consequences. A more formal way to put it, and of course those of you in the Libertarian Party know this very well, is to say no one has the right to initiate aggression against the person or property of anyone else who has not himself initiated force. The important thing to me is that we understand that at root what we're about is liberty, human dignity, individual autonomy. It's not just about utilitarianism or better outcomes, although that is the product of liberty. If you practice the simple system of natural liberty, free markets, private property, the rule of law, then you will get economic growth. You get the kind of growth that you can see out this window, that you can see in downtown Baltimore, that you can now see in Japan, that you can see in every city in America. Not as much growth as we'd like these days, but it is capitalism, it is the simple system of natural liberty that has taken us from merely 200 or 300 years ago, back-breaking labor and short lives, to the incredible wealth that we have in the Western world today and that is spreading increasingly around more of the world. It's not just about economics, although that's an important result, but it's about freedom and limited government. Some of you remember the journalist Bob Novak, who was a well-known syndicated columnist for many years, and then in his latter years a television performer, so more people got to know who he was. And I had the privilege of attending a lunch with Robert Novak when he published his autobiography not long before he died. And I remember one of the things he said there was that when he got invited to give commencement addresses, he would tell the students, always love your country, but never trust your government. I think that's a good motto. Everybody should say that in commencement addresses. And it's a lesson that we have to continually relearn, because there are a lot of people who want to insist that if you love your government, if you love your country, you must love your government. If you love your country, you must not fear your government. You must not distrust your government. And I could read you quotations from President Bush's Attorney General or from President Obama himself, essentially saying that it is unpatriotic to distrust your government. That's wrong. And the reason we live in a free and prosperous country is because distrust of government is in America's DNA, and we do constantly display our skepticism of what the government is up to. And yet, a lot of our political and intellectual leaders don't like that. On the 4th of July recently, the New York Times chose to observe America's birth by publishing an op-ed by Kurt Anderson in which he complained at length that there's just too much freedom in modern America. He wrote, for hippies and bohemians, as for business people and investors, extreme individualism has been triumphant. And he reminisced about the better America of his youth, in which he said, greed, as well as homosexuality, was a love that dared not speak its name. And then he said, what the left and right, respectively love and hate, are mostly flip sides of the same libertarian coin minted around 1967. Thanks to the 60s, we are all shamelessly selfish. Well, he calls it selfish. We call it self-reliance, minding your own business, staying out of unnecessary wars, and raising everybody's standard of living by pursuing your own profit. But that is something so many American elites just don't get, even though they live in and enjoy and flourish in the world that that attitude has produced. My good friend Brian Doherty wrote a wonderful book a few years ago called Radicals for Capitalism, A History of the Modern Libertarian Movement. And he made two points in there. I mean, it was 700 pages. He made a lot of points, but two big points at the end, I think. And that was, libertarian ideas are radical. In the fundamental sense of the word radical, they go to the root of the question of what is the relationship between the individual and the state. And yet, they are also deeply rooted in Western civilization, which now runs on approximately libertarian principles. As we know very well, not on firmly libertarian principles, not on consistently libertarian principles, but as I was saying a moment ago, if you think back just 200 or 300 years ago, what's the difference between our world and that world? It is that we now have a world based on merit, not status, on markets, not mercantilism, on the dignity and equality of every individual, not monarchy and aristocracy and hierarchy, on reason and science, not mysticism and an established church. In all of those ways, we have revolutionized the world, and it's been libertarians, who mostly didn't go by that name, but people with liberal ideas, people who believed in freedom and the dignity of the individual, who made those changes. You know, there was a and libertarians have a record to be proud of in that regard. We have been fighting ignorance, superstition, privilege, and power for many centuries now. The New York Times did a review of Brian Doherty's book, and they didn't take it as seriously as they should have. And one of the things they said was, well, the libertarians talk a lot about freedom, but what about the libertarians who haven't respected the freedom of others? Like, for instance, they had two or three examples, which the reviewer knew about because they're in the book. But he said, Milton Friedman went to Chile and spent 45 minutes advising the Chilean dictator on how to bring his people out of poverty and into prosperity. One guy in the 1950s who was associated with the libertarian movement was an anti-Semite. And there's a couple more things like that. That's it. That's what he had. Maybe there were more, but he didn't know because he didn't know anything more about it that he didn't read in the book. Those were in the book. And I have to say, if that is the sum total of embarrassing libertarian moments, it's a pretty darn good record over 70 years or so. Modern liberals have to deal with the fact, which is not an embarrassing fact, but a shameful one, that their forebears supported Stalin and the Communist Party, or were at least fellow travelers with this organized conspiracy against civilization. As for conservatives, I often mention their long resistance to liberty and equal and legal equality for blacks, women, and gay people, but for today I'll just say George W. Bush and the Iraq War. Libertarians have done nothing in 70 years to compare to expressing support for limited constitutional government while also supporting Bush, his disastrous war, and his accumulation of unprecedented presidential power. Libertarians have a record to be proud of and a record to build on. Libertarians, broadly speaking, in all their guises. And sometimes the task of advancing freedom seems overwhelming. But let me tell you about some people, not so many years ago, who faced a far more difficult task of advancing freedom and how they dealt with it. And because there are some young people here in the audience, I have to pause for a minute and set the stage. This story starts almost 40 years ago, but in a way it starts before that. For much of the 20th century, and for the first 35 years of my own life, the fundamental fact of reality about the world politically was that it was divided by an iron curtain between countries that were partially free and countries that were not free. And behind this iron curtain, there was no freedom of speech, no freedom of the press, no freedom of religion, no freedom of enterprise, no private property. In some of these countries, not even the freedom of silence. You were required to go to public meetings and pledge your support for the government and denounce anyone in your community who might have been heard not pledging their support for government. That was the reality of the world, and we grew up. Those of us who are now aging, past age 50, let's say, we grew up thinking that was just reality. That's the way it's always been and always will be. And then a few things started to happen. And I'm going to start this story in 1978 in East Germany. The United States wanted to place nuclear weapons in Europe. The Soviet Union didn't like the idea of nuclear weapons in Europe, closer to where it was, but a lot of Europeans didn't like the idea of nuclear weapons in Europe, too. So on both sides of the Iron Curtain, there were people who did not like this idea. And on the other side of the Iron Curtain, the East German communist government encouraged protests against nuclear weapons in Europe. They didn't encourage protests against their own government, but against the United States government. That was okay. So they encouraged protests. And so a sort of peace movement developed under the auspices of the East German government. But this peace movement, which was based in Protestant churches, because in Germany the church had been deeply rooted enough that they never completely succeeded in stomping out all churches and all religion. So the peace movement based in Protestant churches began to pray for peace. And that included praying to oppose the mandatory army service and military classes that were in grade school. So this was not exactly what the East German government had in mind. And they began to watch these activists and persecute them. But the church itself, if you were inside the church, you had a safe haven. They would not persecute you inside the church. And Leipzig, the second largest city in East Germany, began to be a place where this was happening. Every Monday evening, people gathered to pray for peace at the St. Nicholas Church, Nikolai Kirche, where Martin Luther once preached against power and corruption. I went to that church a few years ago. It's a small church. Maybe 100 people could get in there. Under constant pressure by the authorities, as I say, they didn't shut the church down, but they pressured. People knew you were not advancing your career, you were not making your family safe by going to these prayers. Attendance shrank to fewer than 10 regulars coming to the Monday evening prayers for peace by the mid-1980s. But it was the only center for any kind of dissent in East Germany, and slowly a few more people came. And then, in the mid-1980s, a new dictator came to power in the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, and he gave some signals that he wanted to be more open, less dictatorial. And a few more people thought maybe things are going to change, maybe it will be okay. So by 1989, the Secret Service, the Secret Police of East Germany, the Stasi, were monitoring nearly 200 separate citizens groups. These groups didn't have much power, but they were there. The regime also, and this is why Germany is important, the regime never managed to fully block West German television. So people on the other side of the Iron Curtain could watch television in their own language, which showed them lives very different from their own. In 1987, hundreds of teens gathered in Berlin chanting, "The wall must go," because they wanted to attend a David Bowie concert in West Berlin. Conservatives used to complain about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So did the conservative communists behind in the other side of the Iron Curtain. And then in May 1989, they held local elections in East Germany. They always had elections in the communist countries. And we knew on this side of the wall, the Iron Curtain, we knew they were a farce. They got 99% supported the Communist Party. In Germany, I think they had a workers' party or something, and it was allowed to get 1% of the vote. But they had these local elections, and some of these people who had come together in the peace prayers said, let's monitor the elections. Let's go out and look at the precincts and see what's happening. And they came back to the churches, and they compared the results they had found, and they watched the television, and they discovered the elections were fraudulent. Not a revelation over here, but it was a revelation to them. And then the disaster in Tiananmen Square in China is a grim reminder of what communist governments would do to protesters. That put a chill on what people were thinking. There was no precedent for a peaceful transfer of power behind the Iron Curtain. And the minister of the Nikolai Kirche said it wasn't imaginable that the German Democratic Republic would end. And I understand, it wasn't imaginable to me on this side of the Iron Curtain. They began to fear a Chinese solution, that suddenly one day somebody would come into the church, into the other places that small groups were gathering, and crack down on them. But Gorbachev was sending signals from the Soviet Union that the Soviet Union would no longer use its military to intervene to protect socialism in its satellite nations. Wasn't clear whether you could believe him, but people listened to that. And then in the summer of 1989, Hungary relaxed its border restrictions, and thousands of Germans fled from Hungary to Austria. The Germans were allowed to go to Hungary on vacation because it's part of behind the Iron Curtain. And then they flew, and then they were able to get into Austria. And more went to Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia, and some of them climbed over the fence onto the grounds of the West German Embassy. And under international law, the West German Embassy is West Germany. So you climb over the fence, you're in West Germany. You're surrounded by the Soviet Empire, so it's not clear what you're supposed to do once you're on West German territory in the middle of Prague. As the summer went on, there was more talk about the possibility of change, and I told you that they got down to fewer than 10 people coming to the Nikolai Kirche for these peace prayers, but the numbers had been gradually growing. September 4th, Monday, thousands of people came to the Nikolai Kirche. As I said, I've been there. Might have held 200. Those people were spilled out in the square beyond. In front of Western TV cameras that were in town for a trade show, young protesters unfurled a banner demanding freedom of speech. The Stasi ripped it down and tackled the kids, the minister recalled. Millions of East Germans saw that scene on TV. A week later, September 11th, the crowd doubled. More thousands of people outside the Nikolai Kirche. And in response to the people leaving to go to Hungary, Austria, the West German Embassy in Prague, these people chanted, "Wir bleiben hier." We're staying here. We're not leaving. We're going to change our country. Monday demonstrations were held at Lutheran churches all across East Germany. The next Monday night, 15,000 people marched in Leipzig. On October 9th, the police prepared to deal with 20,000 protesters. But as the people poured out of the church and into the streets, more than 70,000 Leipzigers joined. And the minister recalled later, 70,000 people who didn't know if they'd come home intact or see their families again. It was an enormous act of moral courage. And slowly the crowd began walking around Leipzig's Ring Road. It's sort of like a beltway, except it's much smaller. You actually could walk around the whole city in the evening. And the police waited for instructions, and instructions never came. So the police backed off. And that was the end of the Soviet Empire. Although it took a few weeks to realize it. I'm sorry, I've told this story many times and I can't get through it. without thinking about the courage it took to do this. The next week on October 16th, it was 150,000 people. The week after, it was 300,000 people from all over East Germany. And again, I have to stress how unprecedented this was. Nothing like this had happened in the Soviet Empire. 300,000 people came to Leipzig to march for peace and maybe for the end of communism, although that was a little less certain. And the party leadership fell. Not the party itself, but the leaders of the party were deposed. On Saturday, November 4th, 1989, more than 500,000 people marched, not in Leipzig, but in East Berlin, the capital of East Germany. And 5 days later, the Berlin Wall, the wall that was a permanent part of my childhood and my young adult life, the wall built to keep people in, was suddenly open. And suddenly is really the word. It happened suddenly and probably accidentally, but it happened suddenly. And millions of people were suddenly free. They could cross. They could go visit their families. A few years later, as I said, I went to Leipzig. I met a man who was then in the German cabinet, but he had been mayor of Leipzig. His name was Wolfgang Tiefensee. And I asked him, were you involved in the protests? And he said, oh yes, of course. And he said, from September 1989, and I hope you know what the Bible tells us, we walked 7 times around the inner city, and then the wall came down. 7 times from September until November 1989. And the minister of an East Berlin church who was involved in this whole process looks back on the events and says no outside force could have done this. That would have meant war. What happened was a self-liberation. Soft water breaks the hardest stone. There is no army, no state, no government program that is as powerful as an idea whose time has come. It often takes a lot of courage to discover that that idea's time has come. We have it much easier than that. We don't have to risk our lives. We don't have to go into the streets. But we do know that freedom isn't free. And for many of us, that means we have to do something. And that's why you're here today, because you want to do something to preserve and expand freedom. I was asked once by some skeptics what the most important libertarian accomplishment ever was. Could have said bringing down the Berlin Wall. But I thought for a minute and I said the abolition of slavery. Okay, they conceded. Name another. Now, I thought the abolition of slavery was pretty good. I thought that if you had the abolition of slavery on your resume, you were prepared to meet your maker. But they said, no, name another one. So I thought a little more carefully, and then I said, bringing power under the rule of law. That was a revolutionary achievement. It is still incomplete. It's what the Levellers and John Locke and the American founders fought for. It's what the protesters in 1989 fought for. It's what Rand Paul filibustered for. It's what Dee works for in the legislature. It's what my colleague Walter Olson works for on the issue of redistricting so the politicians can't create their own districts and maintain their power forever. It's what friends of ours in China and Venezuela and Iran and Brazil fight for in much more challenging circumstances than we face. And it's what you're here to fight for today. So thank you for being part of that struggle, which is an important one and is not over. Thank you.